There we go.
Good afternoon. I've got the lovely Julie with me. Hiya, Julie. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi Donna. Thanks for inviting me along. My name's Julie Anderson, and I'm a writer of crime fiction. And I'm going to talk to you today about this, which is backwards, of course, but is my latest book called The Midnight Man for Hoberg Books, which comes out on Tuesday. I could tell you some more about me, but I'm not sure whether it'd be that interesting.
I'll probably try and uncover as much as I can before the end anyway. So you want to talk about the Midnight Man, but before we do that, do you want to tell us what you've done up to date?
Originally I was a civil servant for many years in Whitehall, and I was made redundant, took early retirement, and decided to do what I'd always wanted to do, which was to write. And I started by, in a small way, writing for my godson and nephew, and produced a couple of young adult adventures, historical adventure novels, basically. One of which was fortunate enough to get listed for a prize, which brought me to the attention of a publisher, who then persuaded me that actually I ought not to write this sort of niche stuff set in historic Spain, and why didn't I write something that would sell like crime? So I reluctantly agreed, and I started on a book called Plague in 2020, which was COVID year. So that was interesting. But that was the first of the Whitehall thrillers, featuring a civil servant investigator called Cassandra Fortune. They were published for Claret Press. Plague, then Oracle, and then finally Opera, which came out in 2022, which was long listed for the Crime Writers Association Ian Fleming Steel Dagger, of which I am inordinately proud and mention at the drop of a hat whenever asked about my books. Specifically proud because Opera was the only book on the list of 12 that wasn't published by one of the big five or one of their imprints. It was the only book published by an independent publisher. Needless to say, it didn't win, but I persevered. But I persevered by going back to, if you like, my sort of first love, which was writing historical fiction, but this time with crime, not in 12th century or 13th century Spain, but a little bit more up to date and set in 1946.
I love the covers of those three books. They're so different. I've seen you speak about them on UK Crime Book Club, and yeah, I love those covers. Who beat you in the end to the CWA? Do you remember?
Yes, I do. It was Agent 16. That was the title of the book, I think, or Agent 17. I can't remember exactly. But it was interesting because, I mean, like most people in that situation, one reads all the books on the list. And when I read that one, I thought, oh, that's clever. And oh, that's very James Bond. That's very Ian Fleming. And it because it was about it's about an assassin. And it was very, very good. And I thought, oh, yes, you know, mind you, I thought that about most of them on the list, apart from my own. But it struck me that that one was specifically well suited to the Ian Fleming dagger. And it subsequently won. I mean, it's very good. It's very good. Recommend it. Recommend all the books on the list, actually, because I read them all. They were all very good. I mean, Ava Glass has gone on to do more, and some of the names. I mean, I couldn't quite believe it that my name was up there with people like Harlan Coben and, you know, J.K. Rowling or you know, Galbraith, and Mike Craven as well was on that year. So I sort of didn't quite know what I was doing on that list. And indeed, I saw it on the Saturday night when it was announced, only because I picked up on Mike Craven's social media the sort of CWA poster with all the books, the covers of the books that had been listed on it. and saw opera. And I sort of couldn't quite believe it, and then told everybody I knew, absolutely everybody. Went to bed having drunk too much, and got up on Sunday morning and thought, oh my God, it's a mistake, isn't it? You know, I shouldn't actually be there at all. Someone's put the wrong book cover up. So went back onto the CWA site, thinking, my God, I'm going to look so stupid having told everybody. And it was still there. So yeah, it was tremendously pleasing. But I, as I say, after that, I decided I wanted to go back to writing historical fiction, and thus The Midnight Man.
And no one can ever take that away from you now, anyway. You've always got proof that you're on the long list. So,
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
with The Midnight Man, what came first? Did the year, or the characters, or the story?
Well, I think the time, not so much exactly the year, but that sort of time, because I decided that I wanted to write about something. I wanted to write about contemporary things, and especially post-pandemic, but I didn't want to write about COVID. But I wanted to write about a society which had undergone a great sort of traumatic experience, a global traumatic experience, and had just come out the other side of it. And it seemed to me that the Second World War was the equivalent of, you know, the COVID pandemic in that sense, because you have this tremendous outpouring of joy that it's over. You know, with VE Day and VJ Day, and then afterwards things get very grim and very hard because austerity was carried on until the 50s. Rationing was still in place. There were things rationed in 1946 that weren't rationed during the war. Bread had never been rationed during the war, but it was post-war because essentially Britain was broke. And it didn't have any money. The supplies of food were still scarce. Building materials were very, very rare. I mean, people talk about, you know, the old Ealing comedies and black and white films you see on TV that were essentially made in the 50s and 60s and set in the 40s and 50s. And the number of bomb sites that you still see in those pictures. But that's largely because they didn't have the materials to rebuild. So there's this sort of hangover from the war, and lots of people coming home with PTSD, although they didn't call it that then, or wounded people, a shortage of everything. Crime was through the roof. The crime figures went up massively during the war. Unsurprisingly, when you think about it, because you know the blackout is a perfect cover for burglary and all those other sort of crimes of property and so on. And I thought, well, that this is very similar to the time that we're in now, when we've undergone this great sort of traumatic experience. We thought it's all over, it's going to go back to normal, and then it doesn't. I suppose the difference between now and then was that then you'd got the building blocks of what we now call the welfare state being put in place. So there was, if you like, a new society was being built for the future. But there were huge changes, massive changes. Britain had no money, couldn't afford empire anymore, was withdrawing from all, you know, its imperial possessions, and creating the Commonwealth. And indeed, in the second book, which is set in 1948, we have the arrivals on the Windrush to South London. So it's all part of this hugely changing picture, societal picture. And so that period began to fascinate me. And I thought, right, 1946. So long enough after the war for people to have started to expect it to go back to normal, even though it didn't. And then I thought, well, where shall I set it? It's got to be London because it's, you know, where I live. And indeed, Clapham. Why not Clapham? That's where I live. And a lot of Clapham now is the same as it was then. The buildings are the same, even though they've been repurposed. I mean, for example, there was the Odeon at the top of Balham Hill. Odeon Cinema, which my characters go to, which is a beautiful Art Deco cinema. And of course, that was the sort of entertainment for the masses then. I mean, people went twice or three times a week because there's no television or anything like that. And that building is still there. It's a wine warehouse, but it's still there. So it was easy, if you like, to use the locations that were on my doorstep. And then I discovered, I mean, what is now an apartment building above a supermarket. I remember as a huge building that was falling down for many, many years. I used to pass it every day on my way to the tube to go to work, which was the South London Hospital for Women and Children, which I'd sort of always known was there, but I'd just seen the derelict bits of it and then seen it knocked down and rebuilt and, you know, parts of it reused. And I did a little bit of research and discovered what a fascinating place it was, and realized that that was going to be the setting for the book, because it was a hospital that had been founded by women for women, and only women worked there. So very unusual, very, very unusual. And it was set up by two ladies who were feminists and suffragists. Maud Chadburn and Eleanor Davis Colley. Eleanor was the first woman admitted to the Royal College of Surgeons. Maud was slightly older. She hailed from Middlesbrough originally, though her family had moved to Kent by that time. When she told, she was the daughter of a Congregationalist minister. And when she told her father that she wanted to be a doctor, he denounced her from his pulpit and said that he would rather his daughter were dead than become a doctor. Now, Eleanor was more fortunate in that her father was a surgeon, so he wanted to encourage her ambitions. But these two ladies met when they were working at the new hospital in North London, which is a women's hospital. It's now called the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, and it's still going. And they decided that, I mean, women wanted to be treated by women, but there were just very few women doctors and surgeons. So they decided they were going to set up a hospital in South London, and they and their friends raised the money. And bought two very large houses on Clapham Common South Side, opposite the Clapham Common Tube, which subsequently became the South London Hospital for Women and Children. It became the largest women's institute in the world, not the world, in the country, the women's hospital in the country. And everyone who worked there, by and large, was female. So from the highest surgeon to the lowest porter, they were all women. There were some sort of expert men. So the hospital engineer was a man, and the hospital accountant was a man. So you did have men around the place, but not many of them. And the rest of the population in that hospital were female. They took patients, women, girls, and boys up to the age of seven. And that was it. And so a complete woman only space. And I thought, that's just intriguing, you know. I've got to set my book there.
Yeah,
So,
absolutely. I can see why.
yeah.
I didn't even know, so I've learned something today. So that's cool. And the research must have been fascinating. I mean, did you know much before you started?
No, I know. I mean, I sort of knew a bit about, you know, the Attlee government and, you know, the welfare state, and I read a lot of books about that, which I found fascinating. I didn't know very much about the South London, and I was very fortunate because I found, or came across a lady called Juliet Boyd, who was a surgeon and anaesthetist at the hospital when it was open, in the 70s and 80s. And I went to see her in Wimbledon, where she was standing as Green candidate for Wimbledon, as it happened. That's how I came across her. And I went to visit her, and she had gone up into her attic and brought down boxes of archive material on the hospital, because she was interested in the history of the hospital when she was there. So she got photographs and leaflets and booklets and papers and all sorts. Going back to when the hospital was founded. And that was fascinating, you know, to read my way through all of that. And I also contacted various other clinicians who worked there, So there was a lady, Deborah Hughes, who is on Twitter and social media, known as the undercover midwife, and she worked at the South London, and she was full of reminiscences of what it was like, as indeed was. There is a Facebook group actually, of which I am now an honorary member, called Women's what's it Occupation 1984-5 Women's South London Hospital for Women. Because when it was closed, or when the local health authority tried to close it first, the place was occupied by women, by nurses and former patients. And nurses continued to provide services, even though the hospital was supposedly closed. And it was a real cause célèbre locally, but also nationally and internationally, actually, because you had women came from Greenham Common, for example, to join in the protests. A lot of women came from around the Commonwealth, because one of the things that the old SLH had was a midwifery school, and they trained a lot of midwives from around the Commonwealth, from Africa and the West Indies and India and so on, the Indian subcontinent. When this protest, this occupation began, a lot of people came who had clearly been taught there and came back to sort of help out with the protests. But unfortunately, the place was allowed to go. I mean, they raised a petition with thousands of signatures that was taken to number 10. And the blood pressure of the people who one talks to, who worked there, when one talks about this, you can see rise, especially when you mentioned that the reason that the local health authority gave for closing it was because it wasn't cost efficient. And everyone who worked there gets furious when that's mentioned, because they say they were super cost efficient. They were more cost efficient than hospitals which were much newer than them, because they'd always had to be, because in the old days they had to raise their own money. They didn't get money given to them. And they have always maintained it was because it was a woman-only hospital, and that's why they wanted it closed. And I think that, and I try to get that in the book, that the people who work there and the institution itself is constantly having to prove itself, because it didn't have any admirers in the male-dominated establishment at the time. It raised a lot of money locally and a lot of money from women who were treated there, but it was not. It was not, oh, I say, we have a visitor. It wasn't, part of the establishment at all. So again, that's another reason why it's exciting to write about, because you've got the sort of plucky hospital fighting against the powers that be, and indeed the women who work there constantly having to prove themselves, because a lot of people at that time thought, well, this isn't what women should be doing. Especially in 1946, because if you think about it, I mean, women had essentially been running the country for the last 6 years, because the men had been away fighting. And now all of a sudden the men were coming back, and the women had to go back to how it was before. Well, actually, quite a lot of those women, in fact, many of those women, had enjoyed freedoms and responsibilities during the war that they would never have got otherwise. And now all of a sudden they were supposed to go backwards, so you've got all that tension at that time, and then you've got this woman-only institution, which is attracting even more attention. So it was, fairly obvious that one had to write about it, really.
Tell us something about your characters.
Well, the two main characters are very different. There's Faye Smith, who is the manageress of the canteen, the staff restaurant there. And she comes from a very close-knit South London working class family, and left school at 14, did various jobs, and then ended up working her way up from being a washer-upper in the canteen to actually running the place. And she's someone whose life has been changed by the war. Because her background, I mean, she was engaged to be married. She was going to go the traditional route, the life that was mapped out for women at that time, until her fiancé died at Dunkirk. And so suddenly she was on her own. I mean, okay, her family were there, but that future had changed. And so she concentrates much more on her job, and grows to love it, and realizes that actually maybe there are other ways that her life can go rather than just getting married and having children. And then the other protagonist is very different, Eleanor Peveril, who was brought up in the Cathedral Close, Worcester, because her father is dean of the cathedral. A very middle class, very beautiful. That's a sort of running joke in the book. That Ellie gets her way all the time because men just can't say no. She's just so lovely, and yet she too has found that the war has upset her life, and she was engaged to be married to a soldier who didn't die, who came back, but for reasons I won't go into here because it'll spoil it for people who haven't read it. Her life changes too. So you have these two women who are both sort of at crossroads in their lives, just at the time that society is in this big process of change. Is it going to go back to what it was before? Is it going to move forward? Is it, what's going to happen? And they come together very under very unlikely circumstances, and a friendship develops between them, even though they don't expect it, and these are, I mean, the other thing to remember is these are women who've been doing it for themselves for the last 6 years. They've been looking after things. And so when a nurse goes missing from the hospital, they decide that they're going to investigate themselves. And the police don't take it seriously. So they are going to investigate it for themselves. And that's how the crime story starts.
Can you tell us without any spoilers, one of your favourite scenes?
It will be almost impossible to do that, I would say. And partly because of the locations, because the locations are very unusual, some of them. I like some of the scenes with there's a character called Beryl, who's a Scottish nurse who knows them both and is the sort of third member of the trio, but a little, I mean, we don't hear her voice directly. The novel is told through the voices of either Ellie or Faye, not Beryl, but Beryl is their friend, and she sort of is in a lot of the book, but has this amazingly dry Scottish sense of humour. So I like some of the scenes when she's generally taking the mickey out of all and sundry, and Ellie and Faye sometimes just can't keep a straight face, even when actually it would be much more politic to do that. So I like those sort of scenes. I well, it's my book, so I would like it really, wouldn't I? I guess.
Yeah. Was there a big difference in the sort of language of that era compared to now, and compared to the other books you wrote, actually quite a different time as well?
Yes. And the answer is yes. I mean, I went around and still am because I'm writing the next two. Went around talking in this sort of 1940s argot, crikey, blimey. I don't quite say tickety boo, but it's sort of almost that very Angela Brazil. So I get strange looks in supermarkets when I'm talking this way. The language is very, very different. And some of it I had to be quite sensitive about because, I mean, clearly, the way that people described other people, perhaps people less fortunate than themselves in those days, was quite graphic. So it was quite normal, even especially, I suppose, in a hospital setting. I mean, you didn't say that people were disabled. You said that people were crippled. And that people with who were mentally challenged were simple, and so on. So I've used some of that language, although I've tried to moderate it, and I've written about it in the afterword and said, obviously, the language we use now is much more enlightened and considerate, but it would be wrong to use that language in a book set in 1946, and I've avoided the worst of it, I think. I mean, one of the things that I, one of the phrases I do use, because it would have been seen in places like the South London, is the phrase baby boom. Because, of course, that's exactly what happened post-war. You know, the men came home and, you know, whoops, 9 months to 12 months later, you had the start of the boomer generation, of which I'm one, you know, as it went on till the sort of 50s, that sort of procreation. And the South London would have been a hospital that would have experienced that, because I mean, they had two gynecological wards, two maternity wards, and they would have seen that at first hand, the number of women who were having babies. But I couldn't find written reference to it until I think 1948, and this is set in 1946. But I've taken it, I've taken a liberty and sort of assumed that, well, maybe it was in common parlance before it was written down. So I've included reference to the, well, in fact, that Faye says to Ellie that there's a baby boom because there are so many babies being born, because, you know, the men are home and active.
Yes. How did you choose your character names?
Well, I wanted a very, I want, again, because they're different characters, very different names. So Smith was the obvious one for the working class girl. But I wanted something fairly unusual, not modern, but not particularly 1940s. So not particularly a Mabel or a Gladys, you know, but something that was a little bit different. So I sort of lighted upon Faye quite early on, actually. And then Eleanor Peveril, well, she was always going to be Peveril, because that's the name of someone. I'm from Worcester, so that's the name of someone I know in Worcester. And she became Eleanor. She had several different first names. She was Rowena for a while, and she was something else. I wanted a fairly upper class name, you know, but not want, you know, I didn't want something that was so unusual as to make her stand out. So I lit upon Eleanor, and of course it gets shortened to Ellie. So Faye and Ellie are the two protagonists, and Beryl, of course, because Beryl has a definite 1940s name, you know.
Yeah,
But
my nan's called Beryl and she was born in 1938, so yeah.
oh well, that's good. That's good. But that's how I got the names anyway. Making sure, of course, that I didn't have too much alliteration or make them start with all the same letter, because I've done that in the past.
Yeah, that's hard. I think one of my characters in my book changed name about eight times, just couldn't decide, and then it was too similar. Or was a similar letter, and I settled eventually. But my goodness, this poor woman, her name changed so many times.
Yes. Yeah, it is. You have to be, you know, quite knowing about, you know, what you call your characters.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm.
Was there anything sort of more difficult when writing this book than you thought of, you know, when you sort of set out? Was there anything that was harder than you expected?
I think what shocked me actually is that for an institution like this, which was so, well, almost unique, really. There was no history. There was no history book about it. No biography of the hospital, no biography of either of the founders, even though Eleanor Davis Colley was the first woman to join the Royal College of Surgeons. She doesn't have a biography as far as I can see. So that's what shocked me, that there wasn't a ready resource there. And I had to, I mean, with Juliet's help, I had to sort of scour the internet and things like Lambeth Archives and various NHS archives to find stuff. And Lambeth were great. I mean, the people who were at the archives there came up with the original hospital plans so that I could actually see what it looked like. But I was very surprised, not to say a little bit shocked, to think that an institution which must have, I mean, it must have taken so much effort to set up. Such an achievement to create this place and to keep it going for so long, and then for it to be just sort of ended, and it impacted on so many, you know, thousands of lives, you know, women and children, and yet no one's bothered to write about it. which
That's
I.
sad as well, isn't it? You know, such a huge bit. I know it's only like that one place, but still, that's huge. It's a huge bit of history that,
Yeah.
you know, girls and women as well specifically deserve to know, I think.
Yes. Well, I'm talking to the lady, the editor of the magazine run by the Fawcett Society, and they're interested in writing a piece on it because it is a forgotten hospital in effect, and it's largely forgotten, I think, because it was very anti-establishment. You know, it was for women and girls. If it had been, you know, a general hospital, or if men had been running it, I think it might be a different matter. I don't know that, but you know, I suspect that. So the Fawcett Society are interested in doing something on it. I'm part of the Royal College of Nursing summer program, and I'll be talking about the hospital and the book, obviously, but you know, but mainly the hospital as part of their program online and in person. And the UK Association of Nursing History are also interested in it. So I hope, in my small way, that you know I'll try and ensure that the hospital isn't forgotten. And it was really interesting when I was talking to the lady from the Royal College of Nursing, the lady who was making the arrangements as to, you know, when I was going to do this, that, or the other. She ended her email. And then she said, "Oh, by the way, I'm related to Maud Chadburn, one of the founders of the hospital. And she is the great, great granddaughter of Maud Chadburn. And I'm going to speak actually tomorrow with this lady, Antonia's father, Peter, who was the son of one of the children adopted by Maud and Eleanor. So he can tell me about them. You know, perhaps not Eleanor, because I think she died young. He would have been too young to know her, but he certainly got lots of stories apparently about someone he calls Aunt Mary, who was Maud Chadburn, who was one of the two founders of the hospital. So that will be interesting. And you know, in a small way, I mean, I know it's just a crime book, but you know, the hospital will live on in its pages, you know. It'll be as a setting for a crime story.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I must admit, when we finish, I'm gonna message my nan and see if she's heard of it. I think she grew up in Luton, but you know, she might have done. So yeah, I just want to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
If you were to be able to spend a day with any author, dead or alive, who would you like to spend a day with?
Well, actually, I think that would change. It would depending on you know where I was and what I was doing. I suspect Charles Dickens, apart from anything else, he would be entertaining, and he liked walking, and he loved London, and he was a commercial novelist. You know, he wasn't an ivory tower type. So I think I'd love to spend the day with him walking around London. But also, oh heavens, well, there are so many. I'll stop at Charles Dickens, otherwise I'll just keep going on and on and on.
I know. I
What
mean,
about you? Who would you spend the day with?
I always think Stephen King, but then I think Enid Blyton, and I'd love to tell her just how massive an impact she's had on children for generations. Like, you know, where her ideas came from, and you know, and just did she know that how huge her name would still be so
Yeah.
many years later?
Yes. No, interesting.
Yeah. What was I just going to ask you? My computer's going funny. Oh yeah, I was going to say you must have met quite a few authors now. You know, have you been to any festivals and things?
Sorry, I've met quite a few authors, yes. I didn't get the end of that, sorry.
Have you been to any of the crime festivals, and are you going to any this summer?
I've done Newcastle Noir, and I'm going to be doing that later in the year for Jackie Collins. I know Alice Hawkins, who runs Crime Cymru, Though I haven't actually been there to that particular festival. As you know, I was going to come down to Brighton, but that didn't happen. And I go to some. I haven't been to Harrogate yet. I must go to Harrogate at some point. I've not been there. Have you been to the Theakstons? Yes. Is it good? Yes. Oh, good. Well, I haven't been there. I've been to Capital Crime when it was in Battersea Park, which was fun. I run one, of course. I run the Clapham, or help to run the Clapham Book Festival. But that's not specifically crime. We usually have a bit of crime, but not just like one session rather than all day or whatever. And that takes quite a lot of my time as well. I do get involved with that. But I've been to a few. I'd like to do more, I think. But thus far, it's just been two or three that actually I've gone I go back to. I do it more than once, which must mean that something's working, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Newcastle's lovely, isn't it? And Jackie's just incredible, isn't she?
Oh, absolutely, yes, she
Yeah,
is.
yeah.
I think I saw you up at Newcastle Noir, didn't I? Yes, I
Yeah,
did.
I've been once. I wasn't able to go last year, and this year I'm like, I really want to because is it the 10th or something year?
I think so. Yes, it's their 10th anniversary.
Yeah, so I'd like to go, but because I just started a new job and I go to all the different festivals, and I'm not sure how much holiday I have left by December. So,
Yeah.
yeah, we'll see. But definitely, a lot of people say they don't want to go to Harrogate because they don't get invited onto the panels and things. But it's more than that. Everything happens in the beer tent, so it doesn't matter if you're not on the panels because everyone meets in the beer tent and just talks to each other. And it doesn't matter if you're not with a big publisher, and it doesn't matter if you're not a writer, even you just chat to each other in the beer tent. It's great.
Right. No, well, that, I mean, I ought to go because I haven't been. I mean, Harrogate's a lovely town, you
Yes,
know.
it's
So
beautiful.
one had ought to go, really. And I'm sure, I mean, whether or not one's on the panel, there'll be plenty of people there, I know. And that's actually one of the really nice things. I've made so many friends through writing crime. Interesting, a friend of mine who was a friend before I became a writer, a lady called Elizabeth Buchan, who is also quite a well-known writer in her own right. I remember her saying to me that crime writers are the nicest people. And oddly enough, people who write children's books are the nastiest, apparently. That's what she said. I think she was probably joking, maybe certainly about the second, but she did say that the cr crime writers were the nicest people. Mainly, she speculated, because they get out their angst all out on the page, so it doesn't leak into their lives. And I must admit, I found that, I've made some amazing friends, and good colleagues. So.
Yeah, I find as well that the darker the writer, the nicer the person. You see some people and you read their books and you're just like, you're such a sweet little thing. Like, you're really tiny and you've got such a sweet little face. And then you write that. Like, where does that come from? It's so dark.
Yes.
Yeah, it's so funny.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, but yeah, the crime writing community is amazing. I love being part of it as well. It's the best thing ever.
Yeah. Well,
Yeah.
yes, and it does. It isn't snobbish in that sense, in that it embraces, readers and bloggers and writers and self-published writers and small indie writers and the lot. From the sort of big prize winner HarperCollins types down to the sort of small independent bookshop type, and it's great. That's really good. That's part of what keeps it vital, I think, and vibrant, in that it's not all based around the sort of the publishing industry as such.
Yeah.
It's all about smaller elements, which are good.
Let's just I just want to ask you a little bit about how you came to be with Hoebeck.
I was asked onto the Hopcast, but in my capacity as one of the organisers of the Clapham Book Festival. So I was on to talk about the Book Fest, and obviously give it massive plugs, the people we've got this year and so on and so forth. And I happened to say that I was writing something different to what I had been writing. And this was just at the time when I think opera was listed for the Dagger. And they sort of said, oh, when's your next sort of espionage, civil servicey spy thing coming out? And I said, well, no, I'm going to do something different. I want to write a historical novel. And I started work on it. And we just got talking after the Hobcast was recorded. And they were saying, well, are you staying with the same publisher? And I sort of said, well, no, because she's not interested in, they're not interested in that. And they said, well, we're looking for historical crime. Would you consider submitting to us? So I sort of said, well, yes, okay. And I subsequently did. And they really liked it. As I have to say, did some other publishers. And I decided to go with Hoebeck, partly because they, although they're small, they're expanding, they're getting bigger, and yet they still retain that sort of small company ethos, which is so much nicer than some of the sort of faceless accountancy-driven sort of publishers. So that's how I ended up writing for them.
Yeah, and I have to say, actually, as a blogger, Rebecca and I used to do it with them. Obviously, it's always Rebecca when she's sending out requests for blog tours. But usually you just get an email and like, this is the tour, this is the dates. With Rebecca, you're like, she's like, oh, if you've got time, these are the dates, and is there any you prefer? And then you'll reply, and then she'll tell you what she's up to or what her sons are doing, and it's really sweet. It's nice. As a blogger as well, to kind of have that relationship with them as well. And I think
Yes.
I'm unique in that. I think she has that with all the bloggers that she emails. So yeah, it is really lovely. They are brilliant.
Yes, they are. So yes, and I'm very, very pleased. Pleased so far anyway. And we'll see. It comes out on Tuesday, so we'll see.
Well, I don't think I have any more questions for you, unless you think there's anything really obvious that I haven't asked you that you want to tell us about.
I don't think so. I think you've asked just about everything, really. Other than to say how much it costs, I suppose, and where it can be got.
Yes, hold it up again as well so everyone can see
Okay.
that cool
Okay.
cover.
Even though it might be, does it come out backwards on
No,
screen?
it's
All right.
fine.
Because then I see the mirror, of course, so I can't see. But yes, this is out on Tuesday, and it's available in bookstores, bookshops. Also online, Amazon, Waterstones, if you don't particularly want to engage with Mr. Bessos Emporium, and Hoebeck's own website, I mean, if you want to support independent publishers, that's what where you ought to buy it from, because that sends more of a proportion of the purchase price, the sale price, to them. They don't have to pay for Amazon's or Waterstones cut. There's an e these are this is at 10.99. It's a reasonable size. It's nearly 400 pages, and the ebook is 3.99, and that's available everywhere you would expect it to be available online. Yeah, that's Tuesday it comes out. So there we go, and I'll be out and about promoting it online, and here, there, and everywhere. So if anyone who watches this sees me in their local area, do come and say hello, and get a book signed.
And I shall put the link up on Tuesday as well when it's out, so people can go directly if they wish to. Thank you,
Thank you.
thank you. It's been great.
Yes, thoroughly enjoyed it. Okay.